This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The Trump re-election. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka, on this Memorial Day Monday, May 29. Thanks for spending time with us, and here's what we have for you this hour.
President Trump is using new ways to push his agenda. Hear what he's been doing since Inauguration Day.
Has separating your bottles and cans run its course? Hear the dirty secret of the recycling industry.
Facts to remember about Memorial Day, like what the holiday was first called.
And is a touchy-feely culture making its way into your office? You're not alone.
I think that the workplace has gotten a little bit more casual in recent years, and kind of the lines between work and life are starting to blur. So some CEOs and employees have told me, you know, they're trying to kind of be more authentic at work, take off that proverbial mask and eliminate that separation. And for some people, that means hugs.
Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Feinzig on what to do when your boss appears to be a hugger. She's here later in the hour. President Trump has headlined four big rallies in the first months of his presidency to tout his agenda and savage his foes. A new $1.5 million television ad campaign promotes his accomplishments and attacks the media. The flurry of activity to build support for Mr. Trump's policies isn't organized by the White House, but springs from his re-election campaign. What re-election campaign, you ask? Here's Frederica Skouten, campaign finance reporter at USA Today. Frederica, what have you seen?
Well, one of the things that has been really interesting about Trump is that he filed for re-election formally with the Federal Election Commission the day he was inaugurated. That is highly unusual. Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama all waited until they'd been president for more than 2 years before they filed their re-election paperwork. Now, there's some practical reasons. He was bringing in money, and so he needed to sort of legally say, all right, I have a campaign re-election committee. But he's also really innovating here. The campaign committee is the sponsor of the four rallies he's held so far in the first months of his presidency. They launched a $1.5 million campaign ad to promote his accomplishments. He is acting like someone who is running, even though he's not formally announced. And one of the things that the folks on his team say is that this really helps him project, I'm going to quote here, the power and authority of the presidency. And it is a way to exhibit to Democrats and Republicans that he is a force to be reckoned with. So he's really using the campaign apparatus to advance his issues.
That's interesting. So what does that mean for rallies? Because did you point out in the story he can pick and choose who attends at times, depending on who funds it?
Yeah, and that's the thing. As you know, if it's a campaign, if it's just like a sort of event funded by taxpayers, right, you would think everybody would be allowed in. Now, his campaign insists that they don't try to restrict anyone, but we've seen at a number of the rallies, protesters have been removed, and that's something that's, you know, perfectly allowable if it's a private event funded by the campaign. He can also sell his merchandise at the event, which is another source of campaign money. And everyone who comes has to get a ticket. And by getting a ticket, you give your name, you give your physical address, you give your email address, so folks know who you are. And importantly, they can contact you in the future, whether it's about supporting the president's agenda, if he's in a fight with folks on Capitol Hill, and they can also ask them for donations.
All right, so that's interesting then. What could this approach by Mr. Trump mean for the midterm elections a year and a half from now?
Well, you know, I mean, he is also helping to raise money for the Republican National Committee, and they had a gangbuster first quarter, the best first quarter that they had after a presidential election in party history. And I think you're going to see a lot of money flowing in. I mean, between Trump and the joint fundraising committees with the RNC and the RNC's own accounts, they raised $53 million in the first quarter of the year. So if they keep up that pace, they'll be at $200 million by the end of this year and, you know, $400 million in, you know, by the midterm. So they're going to have money to really support Republicans in the Senate and in the House. And, you know, President Trump has made no secret of the fact that he would like to have bigger majorities in the Senate. And the calendar this year is not terribly favorable to Democrats seeking re-election in the Senate.
We're speaking with USA Today campaign finance reporter Frederica Scouten. She's written a piece entitled President Trump Seizes on Election Rules to Push His Agenda in New Ways. So I think somebody in the story said this is kind of this could be the new blueprint for presidents. Is this the new strategy, perhaps?
Potentially. I mean, I think in every election cycle, we see folks pushing the envelope. You remember back in the days before we had super PACs, and then there were super PACs, and then each presidential candidate had to have his or her own personal super PAC, and then donors had to have their super PACs. This could be a new trend. The other thing it does, it sends an early warning to competitors. I mean, if you are thinking about challenging him in a primary, or you're a Democrat who is thinking about challenging him, you're already behind.
Right. Wow. Yeah, I didn't even think about that on the primary side. Very good. So when it comes to, I think you touched on a little bit before, but this really seems to be a different approach to a ground game, right? By collecting emails and names of all these people who are showing up to these rallies at early points in his presidency?
You continue to develop this sort of very fresh set of information about potential voters, and then you can target them on social media, via email, et cetera, with messages all along. So again, if you're having a fight on Capitol Hill, you can sort of reach out to these folks. What's interesting, I mean, half an hour before we began talking, the Trump campaign announced that they had a brand new website. Again, touting the accomplishments and selling merchandise just in time for Mother's Day, for instance. You can get a lilac Make America Great Again cap.
Wow.
You buy that cap, they have your information, they'll be talking to you constantly.
Frederica Scouten, campaign finance reporter at USA Today. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. What dad doesn't love to grill, especially when it's a great steak? Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks. And now this Father's Day, for only $49.99, you can get a limited-time Father's Day package when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter deal in the search bar. Omaha Steaks even offers online support with recipes and wine pairings. Here's the offer, 80% off Omaha Steaks Father's Day package, which includes 2 tender mild filet mignons, 2 beefy top sirloins, 4 crispy chicken fried steaks, 4 juicy boneless pork chops, 4 all-beef Omaha Steak burgers, 4 gourmet jumbo franks, 12 ounces of all-beef meatballs, 1 pound of steakhouse fries, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, 1 Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus get 4 additional burgers free. Only $49.99 at omahasteaks.com. Type deal in the search bar and add Father's Day package to your cart. This offer ends soon. Go to omahasteaks.com, type deal in the search bar, grab your dad, and fire up the grill. Salute to our fallen veterans on this Memorial Day Monday. Are smartphones helping or hurting our relationships at home and work and play? We're joined now by Dr. Greg Jantz, psychologist, author, and also founder of an addiction treatment center in Seattle called A Place of Hope. Greg, how do you see this?
This really is the beginning of some real issues that we've got to figure out how to navigate, not just for ourselves, but for our kids as well.
All right, so how do you do that? How do you figure out how to navigate if you're having a problem here?
Well, I'm doing a lot right now on technology and mental health because we know an overuse of technology can increase depression. The more you spend on the social networks, the worse you feel, and it increases anxiety. That said, you've got to have, what's my family or what's my home technology agreement, and we've got to get everybody aboard. You know, I have 2 boys. I have an 8th grader and I have a senior in high school. And my boys have rules that govern the use of technology in our home. And we actually have a place where you put your phone on the charger at a certain time at night, or you don't have it the next day.
Mm.
So what's our rules? What's our boundaries? There's a lot to figure out there, but we need to keep it an open book and be talking about it. And by the way, adults are just as guilty as our kids.
Are they getting the example from us?
Yeah. Well, if you're walking down the hall in your house and you're texting and you run into the wall and you tell your kid he's on the phone too much, that might be a problem.
We're speaking with Dr. Greg Jantz, psychologist, also founder of a place called A Place of Hope. It's an addiction treatment center in Seattle. We're talking about whether or not smartphones are helping or hurting our anxiety. Some who have put together these apps, right, that put you in touch with psychologists or psychiatrists to help deal with this stuff, though, I guess might say that smartphones have opened somewhat of a different door maybe for help.
You know, I would say it puts a connection with somebody we trust. So if you're receiving some help and as a way of, and we do this too, as a way of follow-up and a way to keep that already connection going, but it's just one piece of that pie. So I've got that. I can use that as a communication. It's nice to communicate, hey, I'm in trouble, I'm not doing well, or I'm doing good, and reporting back on maybe homework. But when I need help, I need to talk with a human being at some point. So it's a step in between that can have some limited help.
You mentioned before that spending too much time on social media makes us feel worse. Why is that?
Yes. You know, here's the thing. We're looking for connection. We're looking for to feel better. So what we know and what surveys have shown and what we are seeing here is that the more you're already depressed and you go out there and I'm just online all the time and I'm Facebooking and I'm just in the social media, I end up feeling less connected versus more connected because probably I have some artificial relationships or I have some relationships that really don't represent true relationship or true intimacy, but I'm so dispersed and scattered in my relationships, I feel more disconnected.
When we talk about ages like that, what's a parent to do?
Well, the best thing a parent can do is you've got to engage in their world, talk about it so that we're not hiding it, and we don't want to shame a kid. So one of the things we do, and here's a quick suggestion, once a week, do have dinner together the best you can, and have a digital dinner. It's the one time, pick a day of the week, that if you have kids, that they can talk about anything in their digital world, and you sit there and ask them questions about it. It'll be an opportunity for you to learn about what's going on in their life. And we have a couple different rules. You know, when you're with somebody, be with them. If you're at lunch with somebody and they're texting and they look up at you and they say, what'd you say? Mm. You know, it's disconnection. And so what we want to do is, when our rule is, be together when you're with somebody. If you have something you want to show me on your smartphone, well, ask to show it, but don't make that the centerpiece of a mealtime.
Thanks, Greg. Dr. Greg Jantz, psychologist, author, also founder of a treatment center called A Place of Hope, which is located in Seattle. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to Barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
Thanks for being with us. If you only needed a couple of weeks to blow that resolution about going to the gym more this year, you might blame geography at least a little bit. Here's this morning's Jennifer Koshenka.
Location, location, location. It's true in real estate and apparently in working out. Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal is here to tell us about the relationship between gym distance and working out. Rachel, what have you found?
Well, it's probably not surprising that the closer you are to your gym, the more likely you are to work out more often. But the data is pretty interesting, and what it revealed is really sort of like a four-mile rule. And remember, this is nationwide. So essentially, people who live more than 4 miles away from their gym go significantly less often than people who live less than 4 miles from their gym or fitness center. So, you know, that's kind of a guideline for people to follow if they're thinking of joining a gym.
Did the study look at the time spent? I mean, the commute for some areas would be equivalent to something different in terms of mileage.
Yeah, that's true. So this certainly can vary greatly depending on the area. One of the surprises for me is that a couple of chains, national chains that are actually based in New York City, where people tend to live much closer to their gyms, showed that people were willing to travel more distance to go to them, which suggests that they hold some extra value for their users. So for instance, people who belong to Equinox travel an average of 5.7 miles to get to their club. Now, there are Equinox locations outside of New York, but most of them are in New York or around the city. So that's quite a hike if you live in or around New York City.
Rachel, do you think distance outweighed other factors, such as maybe how many hours the gym was open or cleanliness?
I think that there are a lot of overlapping things here. I talked to one woman who lives in California who said that she used to go to a big box gym. It took her about 15 to 20 minutes by car to get there. She didn't go very often. It was very inconsistent. And then a fitness studio, opened two blocks from her house. So she said that the closeness of that studio was the number one reason why she joined and goes much more often now. But she's also getting a much higher level of service. You know, she's getting guided workouts with a trainer, you know, in a group, and certainly a lot more personal interaction than she was getting at the big box gym.
So maybe people who are tied to certain programs or gyms are loyal to that, but otherwise they'd be looking for something closer?
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, if you're a SoulCycle fan or, for instance, an Orange Theory fan and you're just absolutely hooked, maybe that's enough to get you to go a little farther than you might have to go to go to a gym. So, you know, this certainly depends on the person, but the data show that in general, people kind of hit the wall at about 4 miles or a little over and just go less often.
Rachel, on the other side of the equation, do you think gyms take this kind of information into account when they're looking for new sites?
Absolutely, they do. They're curious to see how far people will travel, and I think that back in the sort of the pre-big data days, they would sort of estimate, you know, okay, let's look at people who were, you know, maybe 3 miles, 4 miles, and, you know, 8 miles away, and that's who we're going to market to. But now it's a little more complicated. As I mentioned, you know, some people are willing to travel much less than 4 miles. Other people might travel 6 or 7 miles if they really like something. So you have to look at maybe different neighborhoods and traffic patterns and see where people are actually coming from to get to your gym.
This morning's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. 30 minutes after the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
Loans are made by WebBank. Rates and terms vary based on credit history. Amazon is not a sponsor of this promotion. Other restrictions apply. See website for details.
I was making great progress on building my savings, but then I get hit with an unexpected car repair bill.
Keeping a close eye on my credit score allowed me to buy my first house, but an unexpected medical emergency set me back.
When the unexpected happened, Avant was there to help. If you need to borrow $1,000 to $35,000, try Avant. It's fast, simple, and transparent.
Everything is done online. There are no prepayment fees, and no collateral is required. And you can instantly check your rate with no impact to your credit score.
Over 500,000 customers have experienced the convenience of a loan through Avant. No wonder Avant has an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau. And now, Avant will give you a $50 Amazon.com gift card after your first payment is made on time. To check your rates and to get this special radio offer, go to Avant.com today and enter promo code 6161 when applying. That's AVANT.com, promo code 6161. Go to Avant.com today and enter promo code 6161.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. Like us on Facebook or send us an email. This Morning at CompassMediaNetworks.com.
Thanks for being with us on this Memorial Day Monday, May 29. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenko. Coming up this half hour, recycling could be in trouble, and it might be you and I who are to blame. Also, what to do when your CEO is all touchy-feely and now likes to hug you upon entry into the office. And things to remember about Memorial Day. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Police agencies that patrol U.S. airports have a message for their rank and file after Chicago officers dragged a United Airlines passenger off a plane, and that's don't get involved in carriers' civil disputes. It's a message that police brass have relayed to officers in cities such as New York City and Atlanta in the wake of that April incident at O'Hare International. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Andrew Tangle, who's based in Chicago. Andrew, what are you hearing?
A couple of agencies said that they essentially told the rank and file in their departments to avoid getting involved in civil disputes, using this United case involving Dr. Dow, the Kentucky physician, as an example. The Port Authority Police Department, which patrols the three major airports in the New York City area, told its officers at roll call, hey, don't get involved in disputes such as overbooking or full flights. The department brass essentially reminded officers that they're only supposed to get involved in disputes when there's a crime committed, an emotionally disturbed individual, or some sort of threat to safety. And we talked to the police major who oversees officers at the Atlanta airport. He's also in essentially a trade association for airport police commanders, and he relayed essentially the same message that they don't get involved in disputes over airline policy.
Boy, all right, so if this is the policy, what happened on that United flight then?
Well, as far as we can tell and what's been disclosed, you know, in those videos that surface online and in the official accounts that we reported, the Chicago Aviation Department officers got involved after Dr. Dow refused to give up his seat at the request of or the order of United Airlines. United had failed to find any takers for vouchers to give up their seats or flight crew could ride that plane to Louisville so they could get on another plane the next morning. They involuntarily bumped the passengers, including Dr. Dow, and he refused to get up. They called the aviation officers. The call might have gone out more broadly, but the aviation officers arrived before the Chicago Police Department, which also patrols O'Hare International Airport. And the aviation department officers, you know, did what's been shown in those videos. They dragged him off the plane. So the police department response from the folks we talked to has been essentially don't use force in such situations. I mean, it would be a likely different, you know, story if the circumstances were different, if there was some sort of threat to safety or some sort of violence or physical altercation on the plane, but that's not part of the story.
Yeah. Thanks, Andrew. Wall Street Journal reporter Andrew Tangle from Chicago. It's 22 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Glad you're with us on this Memorial Day Monday. If you are recycling at home, you are probably doing it wrong. Turns out the industry is grappling with a couple of threats. It's a story by USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. Paul, what's happening here?
What's happening is that people are recycling a lot of stuff. A lot of folks got the nice blue bin at their house, but they're throwing everything in there. They're throwing all kinds of garbage in there. They're throwing plastic bags from the grocery store in there, or your dry cleaning bags, or your garden hose. That stuff is not only not recyclable, it's also tangles up the equipment at the recycling facilities. They've got to shut down. They have to clean it out of the gears and move on to try and get to the good stuff. All of this has been sort of a problem since recycling, household recycling started. But now that the prices that you can get on the open market for recycled, reclaimed material is so low, it's a much bigger deal for the industry.
Interesting. All right, you start off the story saying you were observing one collection facility guy like lunges to save a garden hose from getting all ground up in the gears or whatever.
Yeah, well, and the way these sorting machines work, it's all automated. I mean, the plant I went to, when the truck backs up to the plant and empties out all of the results of your household recycling bin, they dump it on a conveyor belt. It goes through a whole bunch of these sort of gears and jaws and sifters and sorters and across a bunch of conveyor belts with like 38 people plucking out the stuff that is either a hazard or what they call a contaminant, something that is no good for the final product. It takes 11 minutes. By the time it's done, it is baled on a forklift and on a truck and out the door.
Is that right? Once it's dumped from the recycling truck?
Yep.
Wow. That's impressive. Is there such
but the challenge is, of course, it only takes 11 minutes if they don't have to stop the line because there's a garden hose that got tied up in one of the sifters.
Hence the importance of a plucking engineer, it sounds like.
Correct. Correct. A bunch of them. And again, keep in mind, this is an industry where the final product is a bale of crushed up plastic bottles, and the value on the open market of that bale of crushed up plastic bottles is maybe half what it was 5 years ago.
So
their profits are down and their costs are going up because you go ahead and keep sending all this junk that isn't recyclable. Knock it off.
I'll give you that consumers here may be lazy on some fronts, but I think it may be partly because, too, some of the rules are inconsistent. Like where I live, yes, water bottles, right, your Poland Spring water bottles should be recycled. But in my town, not the caps to those things. Or not, for example, the container for my Chinese wonton soup cannot be, recycled. Even though it clearly looks like it's plastic, but we only recycle ones and twos on the bottom of our containers, not five, six, or sevens.
You're exactly right. Part of the problem is, obviously, there's no federal national standard for this. The only reason ones and twos and threes are usually what people recycle is because the rest of that stuff, there's no market for at all. Seven is a joke. That basically means some other plastic. So, where would you send that to melt it down with some other plastic? And the food contaminated stuff is a problem, and the rules, it's all this word of mouth stuff, like the business about the top of the bottle, that's totally 2005. Everything has changed now. The bottle tops, by and large, are now recyclable with the bottles, but the rules haven't changed, and it's never clear exactly what the rules are. So there's an awful lot of confusion for the consumer. For me, the real interesting and still frustrating question is, what do you do with the glass? The glass is worthless, but you're not going to throw it in a landfill, right? That doesn't make sound like the right answer either.
Oh, wow.
But the recycling facilities, they say, well, the stuff is contaminated. If it comes in, if it breaks, it makes the paper that's in that bin contaminated with shards of glass. Mm. So what are you supposed to do? And the answer was, well, send it to a recycling facility, and your city is paying us to get rid of it for you.
How about that? USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. It's Small Business Month, and Dell is celebrating innovators and job creators in a big way, like up to 40% off business PCs big. Even a free 1 terabyte external hard drive with select purchases big. Call 877-BUY-DELL today to connect with a U.S.-based advisor. They're ready to help with tech solutions tailored to your business, like finding just the right Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, because your hard work is more than appreciated, it's admired. Call 877-BUY-DELL today. Memorial Day Monday, thanks for being with us. Is the American office getting more touchy-feely? If this is the culture at your workplace, how do you adjust if this isn't your style? Here's This Morning's Jennifer Koshenka.
As handshakes give way to bear hugs, and in some corners of the corporate world, what do you do if you're not a hugger? Rachel Feinzig of the Wall Street Journal is here to give us some tips. Rachel, why is there more hugging in the office going on these days?
I mean, I think that the workplace has gotten a little bit more casual in recent years, and kind of the lines between work and life are starting to blur. So some CEOs and employees have told me, they're trying to kind of be more authentic at work, take off that proverbial mask and eliminate that separation. And for some people, that means hugs.
Is it possible that germs have something to do with this, with people shaking hands and all these stories coming out about, icky things passing around?
I don't know. I mean, one CEO that I talked to was at a business event, and there was a local government official there who was actually touching elbows because he had a cold, and said he went in for the embrace. So I'm not sure that it's like an effective way of reducing the spread of germs, to be honest.
Rachel, is this men hugging men hugging women hugging women, or all of the above?
All of the above. In fact, lawyers say that you really should be an equal opportunity hugger. So you should not just be hugging one gender. If you are a hugger, you should kind of spread it around regardless of gender.
But does this not open some people up to possible lawsuits or something going awry?
There was recently a case that involved kind of unwelcome hugging. It's set to go to trial next year, so this is something that some lawyers are cautioning their corporate clients about. The lawyer that I talked to urges people not to initiate hugs in the office, and he has some tips for kind of more staid and appropriate hugs. You definitely don't want to linger too much.
We're speaking with Rachel Feinsig of the Wall Street Journal. All right, you're on the receiving end and you don't want to be. What do you do?
Okay, so a workplace expert, Allison Green, who writes the Ask a Manager blog, suggested either holding something in front of you if you know that there's a hugger nearby, and also kind of turning to the side can help to shield as well.
Does that put you off with your boss, though? Could that get you in some kind of trouble?
I mean, I guess it depends who your boss is. I mean, most of the CEOs that I talked to said there's no hard feelings. If they know someone is a non-hugger, they'll go in for the handshake. And all of the huggers that I talked to said they can kind of read when someone's not a hugger. But funnily enough, as Allison pointed out, the huggers all say that they can tell if someone's not a hugger, but according to the non-huggers, that's not true.
This morning's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Feinsig. It's 7 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Morning, America's First News. Reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, where we use the username @ThisMorningShow. You can follow me directly on Twitter, too, with the username @GordonDeal. Thanks for being with us on this Memorial Day. Well, the holiday is much more than just a three-day weekend and a chance to get the year's first sunburn. Here's a handful of facts to give the holiday some perspective from mentalfloss.com. Number one, Memorial Day was a response to the unprecedented carnage of the Civil War, in which some 620,000 soldiers on both sides died. Number two, General Logan made it official. He was the speaker at the Carbondale gathering. Also was commander of the Grand Army of the Republic, an organization of Union veterans. Number three, the holiday was long known as Decoration Day for the practice of decorating graves with things like flowers. Federal law declared Memorial Day the official name in 1967. Number four, calling Memorial Day a national holiday is a bit of a misnomer. While there are 10 federal holidays created by Congress, including Memorial Day, they apply only to federal employees and the District of Columbia. In fact, number five, on May 30th, 1868, President Ulysses S. Grant presided over the first Memorial Day ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery. The principal speaker, by the way, was a Republican congressman from Ohio, a Civil War general named James Garfield, the future president. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.